Hello, right-minded listeners. Did you know that She Writes Press and Spark Press host a publishing contest every year as part of our commitment to elevate and publish more writers of color? Well, this year's contest is now open, and we're accepting applications through July 5th. And at the end of it all, we'll be onboarding two new authors, one to She Writes Press and one to Spark Press. So we hope that you'll spread the word, tell a friend, post on social media, and apply yourself if you meet the criteria. You can find out more at shewritespress.com/equality-in-publishing, or make it easier on yourself by Googling She Writes Press STEP Contest. STEP stands for She Writes Press Towards Equality in Publishing. Thanks so much. Hello, seekers, unravelers, and journeyers. Welcome back to another episode of Right Minded with my co-host, Grant Faulkner, as always. Hey, Grant.
Hello, Brooke.
And grateful to be here with you, of course. You know, I felt pretty grateful also that we are so secured, you know, 2.5 years in with our place as a literary podcast, you know, a podcast that seems to have found its audience in the world of writers and literary minded folks. You know, I was thinking today, because we're talking about displacement, that that's not always a given. You know, this sense of landing where you're supposed to be is not something to be taken for granted. So I thought we would talk big picture about why displacement is such a huge theme among writers of memoir and fiction alike. And I suppose it's as easy as saying that home is home, or home is what you make it. And writers certainly gravitate toward what they know. But why else do you think displacement takes up such a huge space in writing of all genres?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I was just I was watching a webcast with the authors nominated for the Aspen Words NPR Books Award a couple nights ago. And I was thinking about how many of their books and how many books in general are about displacement and migration these days, or maybe they have been forever. And so I was thinking about this very topic. And I think of Tolstoy's famous quote. He said, "All great literature is one of two stories. A person goes on a journey, or a stranger comes to town." So basically two slight variations of the same thing. It's about movement. And yeah, I think there's something true about that, that all great literature is about movement. And, you know, I don't know if it's exactly true, but it makes sense to me, because movement brings on drama, you know, by definition. No matter what, there are questions of longing and belonging and all of the insecurities and dangers that naturally arise when you go anywhere. So I was thinking inertia, or just staying put, you know, mainly brings on internal drama, but movement creates drama with the rest of the world and with yourself. And that's probably why I've written a fair number of stories about my birthplace, Iowa, and why I seek out other places, because there's a tension of being in the place you're supposed to be, or abandoning it, or fleeing a place. So living in other places, or just going to them, is essentially my favorite kind of writing prompt. What's your take, Brooke?
You know, I'm a native Californian. I grew up in Southern California and on the coast. And so I think about this sense of place from that vantage point, you know, spending most of my life here. I've been in the Bay Area for more years than I lived in Southern California at this point. But the older I get, the more I think about place and home and belonging, honestly, because living here does make me think about the danger of living in a place like the Bay Area that is so tied to natural disaster. You know, obviously, these last 5 years, we've been living with so many fires. There's always been the threat of an earthquake. I remember so clearly the 1989 earthquake, and I was living down in Southern California. I was 13 years old, but it was such a big deal, such a news story. It felt very close to home, even though it was miles and miles away. And all of this is just really pertinent today, because we're speaking with Carol Edgarian, and her new book, Vera, is centered around the San Francisco 1906 earthquake. And these very things, you know, a quake and fires destroyed the city, 80% of the city. So it was a huge deal. I mean, we all hear about it, but it's another thing to really immerse yourself in a book on the topic. And what she's done, of course, is touch into an existential fear that I imagine most people have when they live here, you know, just thinking how the Bay Bridge collapsed in 1989. And so I read Carol's book very much thinking about home, and how my experience of home is not so much about displacement, but certainly about fear. you know, living here does elicit some bit of fear, and the fear that possibly you might be displaced. And then curiously, I was reading this, you know, at the end, mid-April, basically, as we were preparing for the interview, and it just happened to be the exact day of the earthquake, which was April 18th, 115 years later. And so that was a little eerie, mainly because I thought, like, oh, it could happen any day, like today.
I'm bracing myself. I'm sitting here holding the table. I will say that living in California has its very own particular drama because there's just so much danger embedded in the land. When I moved here, somebody told me that the state had a natural disposition towards risk-taking or disregard for risk, and that's because of the gold rush that brought so many people here and all the other types of rushes that followed. And then to live on top of a fault or in incendiary dryness like we do now requires a certain level of denial. And California is a place that so many people move to, Brooke. When I moved here, people told me that it's rare to meet a native San Franciscan, and that's proven to be true. People are always moving here and away from here, and then a lot of people immigrate to California from other countries. So displacement is part of the fabric of the state's drama.
Yeah, that is so true. And we have obviously a lot of transplants and a lot of immigrants, and it's obviously true of all big cities. You know, we'll talk more about all this with Carol in a minute, but she's the child of immigrants and the child of parents and grandparents who have been displaced. And so that is a lot of what informs her fiction. And one side of her family survived the Armenian genocide. And so, of course, that's a different kind of displacement and the kind that will certainly weigh heavy on your heart. And so many writers are the receivers, of course, of their family traumas passed down. And then you grow up with these stories. And when they're stories of home and displacement and longing, I feel like it's almost impossible that those themes don't make it into your fiction. And certainly they make it into your memoirs if they're part of your lived experience. And I was thinking about 2 summers ago when I went back to Croatia with my mom and my brother and my son, and we did that trip to visit my grandfather's homeland. And I saw just a small glimpse of the power, you know, that the place held over my mom as a person who was born to a first generation American, who was my grandfather, and both of her paternal grandparents were Croatian. And the stories of homeland and what she was exposed to growing up with that were such, or are such, you know, an integral part of her makeup in a way that I don't have, you know, even just being one generation removed. And so I loved being there, but I didn't have that same connection that she did. And so I just thought about how powerful those forces are that live inside of us when we're informed by, you know, even by our parents or our grandparents, and then how that gets diluted, you know, through the passing of the generations. And, you know, I know that we talked about this, Grant, a few episodes back when you were saying that you didn't have a strong sense of family history in part, which was why you write about the present. And so I'm curious to know if you feel that displacement anyway, you know, just as someone who has moved from Iowa to here or otherwise. And I know how much you feel the compulsion to write about home and how present Iowa is to your identity. So so what is that level of displacement for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a type of immigration to go from one region to the other. It's not dramatic like it is moving from a country to another, but I'm intrigued by that attachment and that displacement. You know, I haven't lived in Iowa for 30 years and I know fewer and fewer people there. So I'm just intrigued by the large place it plays in my identity and thoughts. And it's also interesting to me to just think of another self, like one who didn't move away, and what that means. Like there's always kind of this other self living there. And then to loop back to what we've said today, you know, isn't it fascinating that we're living in a country defined so much by movement and by a disregard for rootedness, that we seem to always be restless and looking elsewhere? And I don't think this condition necessarily affects those who live in other countries or not in quite the same way. I mean, in some ways, when I think about it, I was raised to move away, whereas most people in the world are raised to live in the same village or even the same house or same room as their family. And I think sometimes I used to teach English as a second language on the Arizona-Mexico border, and I often think of my students because most of them told me they wish they could have stayed in Mexico. They'd only migrated to the U.S. to earn more money, so their sense of home was elsewhere.
I definitely relate to that idea of being raised to move away, and interesting to think about the different value systems too that different people have and why they move or if they get forced out. There's so many thoughts to consider here. So, well, as both of us being transplants to the Bay Area who've called this place home for so many years, I'm excited to talk about Carol Edgarian because it's true of her story too. And Grant, you and Carol also happen to have in common that you run a little side hustle with your literary magazines. She has this very popular site called Narrative, and you run 100 Word Story. So I imagine in a lot of ways, both of you would probably rather be writing fiction full time if you could. So maybe we're going to see the sparks fly.
As long as the sparks don't fly in the dry, grassy hills of California, we will be right back with Carol right after this short break.
Welcome back, everybody. Today's guest is Carol Edgarian, and Carol's novels include the newly released Vera, the New York Times bestseller, Three Stages of Amazement, and the international bestseller, Rise the Euphrates, winner of the ANC Freedom Prize. Her work has been described by the Washington Post as notable for its generosity of spirit, intelligence, humanity, and ambition, and her articles and essays have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, NPR, and W, among others. And she's also co-edited the popular collections drawn from writers' diaries, The Writer's Life. Carol, importantly to our local community, is the co-founder of the nonprofit Narrative, narrativemagazine.com, which is a leading digital publisher of fiction, poetry, and art, and of Narrative in the Schools, which provides free libraries and writing resources for teachers and students around the world, which is super cool and wonderful. Carol, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be with you guys.
Yeah, and it seems only appropriate that we start with a question about Vera, your new novel that dives headlong into San Francisco in 1906. And we, you, me, and Grant all live here in the Bay Area. You're in San Francisco and we're in the East Bay. And in 1906, that quake destroyed 80% of the city. And I want to ask you what it was like to dedicate yourself to living that history when you live in San Francisco yourself. And, you know, I already have this existential dread about the eventuality of having to live through something like that someday. So what compelled you to take on this subject in the first place?
Well, I think living here, it's always top of mind, isn't it? When is the next one coming? And certainly while I was writing this book, I was obsessively stockpiling water and mm-hmm. making sure that we had gloves and boots and all that stuff. But, you know, I've been out here for some decades. I grew up on the East Coast, and the 1906 earthquake always was a fascination for me. I started collecting books on it years ago, and didn't think I would center a novel around the event, but I was fascinated by this notion that, you know, in under a minute, an entire society could be leveled, that a city could collapse. And of course, it was the quake and then also 3 days of fire that just really wiped out San Francisco in 1906. But when I was starting to think about this book, I went back to that place and I started researching. And at the same time, this was right before the 2016 election, and we were gearing up for that. And it seemed to me that our society was very much at a tipping point, at a precipice. And I thought, you know, I started conjuring what would be a metaphor for society collapsing, and what would come out of it. And I'm sort of drawn to the political moment and the societal moments in centering a novel. And of course, in the 1906 quake, it was also a time of incredible political corruption in San Francisco. So all that seemed very relevant to me and became more so as I spent 6 years writing the novel.
So interesting. And Carol, you've talked about the hubris of San Francisco, and San Francisco is a character as much as any other character in your book. So I'm curious if you can tell us about your relationship with San Francisco. And I know this isn't your first novel set in San Francisco.
I know. I never thought I would write two books set in San Francisco. But, you know, clearly it's a place that's caught my fancy. When I came out here, I felt as if I had sort of found a place that was mine, that didn't have all the history of the East Coast. Of course, it has a different history. It has this history. And I love the town for its inherent drama, you know, the hills and the valleys, the microclimates, the idea that at any moment a quake could hit. And its basic character of just this place founded by people who were looking for gold, and that incredible optimism and the entrepreneurial sort of zeal of San Francisco. And like you say, Grant, the other side, the shadow side of that, is this incredibly inflated, hubristic quality that, I mean, the two things in terms of fodder for fiction are really rich to mine both sides of it.
It's still with us, right?
It's still really with us. I mean, San Francisco is a place of shadow and light. I mean, huge, huge bounty and equally huge blind spots.
So interesting and true. And I felt so present to San Francisco in that 1906 era, and even felt compelled to go watch that footage that you referenced of Market Street in 1906, before and after the quake. And I hope our listeners will go do that, because it's astonishing.
Yeah, a trip down Market Street. And what was so amazing is it was filmed, you know, just a few days before the quake and would have been lost, but they put it in the mail to get processed in New York. Otherwise, we would never have it. It's amazing. And then, of course, to see the same trip down Market Street through the devastation.
Yeah, people really ought to go look at that, because it really is an amazing piece of footage. And I want to segue here into the theme of displacement, which is so prevalent in your work. And I know there's a lot to unpack here about why you write about displacement. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit, you know, about what that is in your own history, genetic makeup, or predisposition as a human being that draws you to write about this theme.
Yeah, well, in my story, all four of my grandparents were immigrants, and on my father's side, they were Armenians who, you know, brought with them the incredible scars of the Armenian genocide, which, by the way, I very much in the news today. And on my mom's side, they came from Sweden. They were alcoholics. They came during Prohibition, really against their will, thinking that that would cure them, thinking you couldn't get hooch in America during Prohibition, which, of course, wasn't true. And my mother was taken from her family when she was 5 and put in an orphanage, where she stayed till she was 18. So on both sides, there is this sort of legacy of trauma and displacement. But I also think, I mean, that's what's personal to me, but I also think it's a very American issue. So many of us have dealt with one form of displacement or another. So many of us in this country are looking for home and haven't found it. So it's something I'm constantly turning over.
I love that. I think the same thing often about how we're all looking for home, and we're essentially not ever going to find it by definition. And it makes me think that Vera is also very much an adventure story in so many ways. And in the days after the quake in particular, you know, the wildest things are going on in the city and people are doing whatever they can to survive. And Vera is really coming into her own in this time. And so I'm curious, how did you position that sense of adventure into the story, and what allowed you to see that rather than just the pure devastation that obviously followed the quake?
Well, I think what pulls you through, if I've done my job, what pulls the reader through is Vera's spirit, her optimism, her quest, if you will, to find her people. And, you know, she starts out thinking she's looking for her mother, who's a madam in town and who only sees her three times a year and has basically put her with a foster family. So she's already yearning for place, for home, for love. And then the quake happens, and sort of willy-nilly, she does find her people. They're not the people she would ever have expected she'd find. And, you know, her sense of both desire, which of course is, you know, you have a character when you have that kind of burning desire. There's nothing casual about a good character's desire. Her desire to find something is by definition generative. You know, she's seeking that place. So even though she walks through hell, she's on a mission to rise. She was not in a great place even before the quake. So I think that's what pulled me through. And of course, the people around her, the ones who show up in ways that she couldn't expect, and they surprise her in the best ways.
And that's what just part of what makes it such a great story, is such compelling characters too. And I wanted to ask you about your self-professed status as a political junkie, and me too. I'd like to hear about how that in particular informs your fiction, because your work is clearly scratching at the political, and Vera is full of city politics, and the historical research is both incredible and super interesting. So how do you think about infusing whatever the politics are of the moment into the books that you're writing? I mean, both our moment now and the moment then, right? I mean, I sort of saw both.
You know, I think I look for stories, both as a writer and a reader, that feel like the news of the day to me. The news of the day, if it's historical, of that time, but more compellingly, if it also feels like the news of the day of our time. You know, you can't predict what the moment is when the book is ultimately read. I mean, I finished this book in January of 2020, could never have predicted the pandemic, and that would be a whole different context to think about these characters moving through a catastrophe that is, you know, and having to be on the other side of survival. But in terms of the politics, I can't get enough of it. I just think politics are inherently dramatic, and at their core, they bring out the best and the absolute worst of human folly, human ambition, you know, all the delicious aspects for story. It's all right there.
Power drives so much.
power and lack of power.
Right.
You know,
right.
The other side of it, the other side. I mean, look at what we've walked through in the last year. You know, when I was 16, I was a Senate page, and it was a life-changing moment for me. I actually haven't written about it, but am thinking about it. And one of the great things was, when you're a page, you sit on the floor of the Senate and you're invisible. And it was great training for a writer, because they would sort of, you know, horse trade right over our heads, literally a foot from us, and didn't even know we were there. We were just invisible. And it was amazing to watch that, and to watch how, you know, to quote Biden, how the sausage gets made.
Well, I wish I could assign that as your next novel, so consider that.
Okay.
but I want to make sure to ask you a question about Narrative Magazine, which is, you know, of course, super beloved here in the Bay Area and beyond. But it definitely has a West Coast sensibility. And when I'm traveling through the Bay Area, writing circles, I, you know, encounter so many people who've written for you or judged for you. And I also have a little literary magazine called 100 Word Story. So I know the passion that drives this kind of endeavor.
It's amazing.
Yeah, thank you. But I'd love to hear what keeps you inspired on this after all these years of doing it and what this year, the pandemic year, has been like for narrative.
That's a great question. You know, we're celebrating 18 years. I can't believe it. And I'll tell you what inspires me, and particularly this year. You know, we've always made all of everything we've published available for free. And so what's happened, and we couldn't have planned on this, but what's happened is our readership has exploded, not just in the States, but all over the world. And because it's a library of fiction, poetry, essays, art, teachers have found it. So in the pandemic, we saw, like, right at, in March, when sort of the whole world shut down and 90% of students were being taught online, we saw a big spike in traffic. And that has continued from teachers and students and readers around the world, you know, in Southeast Asia, in South Africa, in Russia. So that inspires me, like, how do we build communities? How do we share our stories, not just literati to literati, but to, you know, around the world, of people hungry for connection, of hungry to find inspiration. We just did a high school poetry contest, and we had entries from 19 countries, including like little remote villages in India and Serbia. So that inspires me as both a writer and someone who works with an amazing group of people on narrative, of just, you know, how to get the word out there in this moment where so much talk is about division. How do we find more connection?
Oh, that's so great, Carol. Thanks for that answer.
Well, you know, and I, please, everyone, go on narrativemagazine.com and read the winners of this poetry contest. They are so amazing. You know, these are 15 to 18 year old kids who, I shouldn't call them kids. They are full-fledged poets and writers who deserve incredible respect and many, many bows.
That's exciting. Good for you guys. And thank you. Well, I'd want to end on a question about home. I watched your recent interview with Tobias Wolff on Book Passage, which is another great interview. And you said something that struck me. You said, "We're all trying to get home," which sort of alludes to what Grant said earlier, too. You know, it's like ironic, right? We're trying to figure it out, but it's not really possible to find, perhaps. And clearly you're tackling this. It's a centerpiece in many ways. But what does home mean to you?
That's a great question. You know how when you ask a good, when you ask a really right question, there's that. I mean, that just dropped down to the center of my body. So that was, home is the place, I think we carry our home. Home is integrity. Home is love, and the people you care about. It's also, you know, one of my favorite words is grace. And I think like home should sit next to grace. And I don't mean grace in any kind of religious way. I mean grace in terms of ultimate connection. And that's home. That's home.
Beautiful. Thank you, Carol. Thanks so much for being on Right Minded.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carol.
Thank you for having me, guys.
We will be right back with today's book talk.
Today's book pick is called Stepping Stones, and it's a children's book. It's a refugee family's journey. And the reason that I chose this is because it has the stone artwork of the Syrian artist Nazir Ali Bader, And it's by a Canadian children's writer, Margaret Ruhrs. And she discovered Ali Bedir's work and was so impressed that she found a way to create a story around Ali Bedir's stones. And it's a super unique book that I've had for about a year. And I just wanted to bring it in because we're talking about displacement. And I think it's so important to talk about the fact that there are so many different regions of the world, Syria, obviously, in particular, but Eritrea and Sudan and others, where the crisis is really pushing people from their homelands. And I know we've already begun to see books about these kinds of crises, but I think in generations to come, these are going to be the stories that take up our space in the way that so many Holocaust stories take up our space in the last generation. So it's something to make yourself aware of, make your children aware of by these really fascinating children's books that are out there about refugee crises and what's going on in the world. So I highly recommend it. And before we segue to the end, I also just want to put in a plug to get on YouTube and type in Market Street, San Francisco, 1906, because it really is incredible footage. If you haven't seen it before, taken 3 days before the quake. I have lived here a long time and I just had never seen that footage. And it really brings home the era of Vera and this story and what it must have been like to live in 1906 and through the earthquake. And if you haven't read Vera already, it will just make you want to dive right into the book. So lots of stuff to recommend here at the end of the show today. Thank you.
Thanks, Brooke. And I want to thank listeners for taking this weekly writing journey with us on Right Minded. You know, we don't have a marketing budget for this, so please tell your friends. Please even tell your enemies, because it will give you something to be friendly about with them. We are available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and we will see you next week.